Millions in federal funding could soon be on its way to deepen the St. John's River to attract bigger ships. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, why the president's budget is good news for Jaxport. Give us a call as we talk about this. It's 549-2937. Then later, don't miss some singing Valentines live in studio from the Jacksonville Harmony Chorus. But first, this morning, two big stories we're following today. President Trump's proposed federal budget includes a big line item for this area's own Jaxport. The port announced Monday it will receive $93 million in federal funding for deepening the St. John's River. Part of that comes from Trump's budget. Now, the deepening project is meant to attract bigger cargo container ships, and the port says more jobs. More about that in a moment. But first, lots of reaction around town this morning after Mayor Lenny Curry proposed a whole new slate of board members for JEA. David Bauerline of the Florida Times Union joins us now. Hey, David.
Good morning, Melissa.
And what are your thoughts about these stories? You can join the conversation. It's 549-2937, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. All right, let's begin with this JEA latest. The entire JEA board quit last month in a group. So the mayor has proposed replacements that have to be confirmed by the city council. They are business and healthcare executives and the president of Edward Waters College. Your initial thoughts?
Well, it's an interesting group. There are two former board members who already have some experience in JEA back, arguably in better times. That's Marty Lanahan and also Bobby Stein. Stein is interesting because he also is a member of the Jacksonville Civic Council, which, to say the least, was very skeptical about the whole idea of selling JEA, putting it up for sale. So he was one of the co-chairs of the committee within the Civic Council, which is this group of sort of influential business and civic leaders that really studied very closely this, raised a lot of questions, a lot of objections. So you're going to have somebody on that board who goes in already with the mindset that he's not interested in putting this utility back up for sale, which is something that we've already heard from, you know, city council members, the mayor himself. But you do have somebody on the board now who's going to be on there for, you know, presumably a while, who's going to have that view. And that means that hopefully if this idea ever percolates up again, there's going to be at least one board member who's asking questions at the front end in public about what's happening.
Some city council members say they weren't consulted about this proposed slate of board appointments. They will have to confirm them. It showed there's a bit of a rift, it seems, between the mayor's office and some members of city council.
Right. So I think my understanding was that council members were able to kind of float names, turn over names. But the final selection, I guess some council members said, well, they just heard about it when news reports came out. So to what extent the names that actually were put forward by Curry came from council versus just kind of maybe going through the motions and saying, give me some names, and he ended up picking the people he ended up picking.
Now, because of the entire controversy and scandal around JEA, there's been a lot of discussion about how these board members should be appointed in the future. An emergency resolution failed last night. It was proposed by Councilman Garrett Dennis that would have given the council power to appoint some of these members.
Yes, and that's similar to some other panels around town that do it that way. It would be probably, it's always difficult for a committee of 19 to come up with recommendations. So usually it would be the council president would be the one who would decide it and put those names into the hat. And the reality is that even though city council does have the power to confirm or deny appointments made by the mayor, it's just tough for a council to come out and sort of say to somebody who's willing to step up, do the job for nothing, put in lots of hours, you're just not worthy. And so a lot of times then, the only way the city council can really have a stamp, if it wants it, on this would be if there's certain seats that are reserved and set aside for the council. I think Garrett Dennis had talked about three or four of the seven members being appointed directly by council and the other ones by the mayor. And that could create a little more of a balance in terms of the legislative and executive branches in terms of sudden mm-hmm. changes or turnover in that that body.
Now, as you said, David, all of the names proposed are solid citizens, successful in their fields, civically minded. They're likely to be approved. Let's be clear. That said, we do have an email from one listener pointing out that none of these members, proposed members, seem to be oriented toward putting JEA where it needs to go, stimulating local investment in clean energy. If City Hall really wants to clean up JEA to prosper in the 21st century, they need to appoint advocates like that to the JEA board.
Well, that's a good question. I'm certainly not aware that any of these appointees announced by the mayor are known for that or have a particular expertise in that. So that may be a good valid point in terms of what they're going to bring to the discussion and the policy. Certainly a lot of the move is in terms of energy efficiency, renewables. A lot of that is going to be top-down, what the federal government does, which that's why you have a presidential election this year.
Speaking of the president, let's move on to the other big story you've been covering in the paper this week. A big infusion of federal funding to deepen the port, the St. John's River shipping channel at Jacksport. Now, is this the first time the port has won funds from a president's budget?
My understanding it is. Usually it's complicated, Byzantine in terms of how these things are done, but usually it's very hard to get into the president's budget. And then after the president's budget comes out, then Congress finds a way to find additional money that it adds to it, and there's a big sort of log rolling in among Congress on how that gets done. So it's very unusual for something like this to get into the president's budget for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And once it's in the president's budget, it's almost virtually assured that it's going to get through when the final budget's passed. So that is a big accomplishment in terms of how Jacksport and Jacksonville have been able to sort of elevate this project and get that kind of attention. President Trump, I'm sure, wouldn't mind campaigning on that when he comes through Jacksonville.
We are talking with the TU's David Bauerlein. We'll go to your calls in a moment about two big stories, JEA and Jacksport, at 549-2937. Okay, so winning this funding means that Jacksport can do the next phase of this dredging project, all the way to Blount Island, right? So that they can compete for these, they're called Panamax-ready ships, bigger cargo ships that come through the Panama Canal from Asia.
So it gets them closer. I think the figures they gave us to Jacksport is to do the whole thing, 11 miles from the ocean to Blount Island.
So this won't get them to the end.
It won't. And so there's going to be almost surely a request at some point this year from the Jacksonville Port Authority to the city council for some city funds to help to fill that gap. And that's really going to be interesting because we haven't really had a debate at the city level yet on this particular project. We almost had one 3 years ago, and then the port kind of backed off asking for any kind of a financial commitment. But you're going to have all these issues that are going to come up in terms of environmental mitigation, probably from some council members. There's probably going to be, some discussion about flooding. There's going to be a lot of different issues that are going to come up. And so it could be an interesting debate at the city council level in terms of, how much money do they want to put towards a project? If they do, I would suspect that there's going to be support from city council. Are they going to want to add some strings? Will they want to add additional money above and beyond that for any of these other factors that may be community concerns? So it's going to be a good debate coming up for sure.
That's right. Now, of course, the argument all along the port has been making is this will create more jobs. This is a driver of economic growth for this city. They proposed that this deepening project would create thousands of new jobs, although other independent estimates said that was probably overly rosy. But, of course, the big negative about this is environmental impacts to the river. And then also, when you dredge 12 to 13 miles down to 47 feet, you're creating basically a welcome mat for water to come in and slam the city of Jacksonville in the event of severe weather, which is what we saw during Hurricane Irma in particular. Then advocates that have spoken out against this say all we're doing is making it easier for severe flooding to slam into urban areas in the event of another major storm.
Right. My colleagues, Nate Monroe and Chris Hong, wrote a really great series a couple of years ago just about how over the period of decades, deepening the river means, because it's a tidal river connected to an ocean, you kind of open the mouth bigger and bigger. And where's that water going to go? It's going to come up into Jacksonville and all the development along the riverbanks and all the tributaries. So it's interesting. The St. John's Riverkeeper, which is the organization that's sole mission is to protect the health of the river, they did file a lawsuit, which is still pending in federal court. They're arguing that when the big National Energy Policy Act review of this project was done, that they didn't do enough to look at what the impact would be in terms of flooding, and they didn't do enough to examine what the impact would be of the salt water coming in and increasing salinity in the river. So that lawsuit is still pending. It's kind of weird. It's been dragging on while, meanwhile, the dredging has happened full speed ahead. But there is this concern that when you deepen the river and there's more water coming in, that's going to create a situation when you have, say, a Hurricane Irma situation where it's going to cause more massive flooding.
So in that sense, both of these stories, JEA and Jacksport, are connected in the sense that Jacksonville is one of the most vulnerable cities in America to these climate change impacts. And it's the biggest city in Florida by landmass, but it's been the slowest large city in Florida to sort of get hip to this and take aggressive steps to protect itself. And with its major institutions and players like the port, like JEA, city government, this is not at the top of their agenda. And we see that reflected in these stories.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, now the Army Corps and the Port Authority have argued in court that these issues were studied. They did look at these matters and that the federal law was fully complied with in terms of how that study was done. You know, I don't think back when this was done that flooding was as big an issue heading into those studies as, say, the increasing saltiness of the river, which really does have effects on marine life and everything. I would suspect that in the future, there's going to be much more analysis in these studies of how sea level rise interacts with the dredging project and how that all affects neighborhood flooding and everything. But yes, you're right. I mean, it kind of all is of a piece in terms of how, look, the dredging is not done in a vacuum. There are consequences, intended and unintended, of any large environmental project like this. And that was the goal of this process, was to analyze those. And if they identify them, how do you correct them?
Okay. And if you're just tuning in as we talk with the TU's David Bauerlein about JEA and Jacksport News, give us a call. It's 549-2937. Rebecca is in Lakewood. Hi, Rebecca. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. So my comment was about the JEA board members that have been proposed by the mayor. What concerns me is that there are no women among those named, unless I'm misreading that.
Oh, there's one. Marty Lanahan, actually. There's one.
Oh, okay. I thought that was a...
But yeah, you know, that's come up. People have looked at the list of names and thought, is this all male? And yeah, there is one woman proposed, and I appreciate that call, Rebecca. Marty Lanahan of Iberia Bank used to be Regions Bank. So, yes.
One of seven? Is that
one of seven. Names? Right. Yeah, only one. So, yeah. One is better than none, but I take your point, Rebecca. And there's diversity on this list of proposed board appointments. You've got Leon Haley of UF Health and Zachary Faison of Edward Waters College, two African-American leaders in this community. And so, again, these appointments have to be confirmed by the city council. And as we continue talking about it, let me get to some tweets for David Bauerlein. Here's one from Jay. The millions that will be spent to finish the dredging would be better spent on schools, development of public spaces, or social programs. Funny how Jacksonville can always find money for pet projects, but not the things that help people. You know, it depends on where you stand on this issue, whether you really like the idea of creating more jobs around Jacksport or whether you think this is a bit of a boondoggle. Here's a tweet from Jim. Will all of the federal money be used for dredging to accommodate Panamax ships, or will some of it be used for the dredging to accommodate the newer and bigger Eagle LNG export terminal, which is also right over there?
So it's not necessary. The dredging is not necessary for the LNG terminal. They don't need that. They don't have the real deep draft ships because they're just going to be taking their liquid natural gas to the Caribbean. This dredging is for the big ocean crossing ships on the Asian trade lanes. And those ships are getting bigger and bigger, just like everything's getting bigger and bigger in terms of economies of scale. So then you have this race among Southeast ports to deepen their harbors so that they can compete for those ships and bring in that cargo. It's not the biggest part of Jacksonville Port Authority's cargo right now. They're still Puerto Rico, the Caribbean. That's really where the bulk of their cargo comes and goes. And those ships don't need 47 feet of water. But the part that's the Asian trade, that's the fastest growing portion of the business, probably the area of their business that could potentially grow the fastest in the future. So that's why they're spending all this money on it.
Here's a tweet from Frank about the JEA board. Do you see a conflict of interest with one of the board members donating up to $100,000 to the mayor's PAC?
I don't think it's a conflict of interest. I mean, it's certainly worth knowing that the person is somebody who's a large...
And I'm not sure which person he's referring to.
So he's referring to John Baker.
Oh,
who,
right.
I think our story reported he's given about $160,000 to Curry's reelection campaign. And John Baker is currently on the Jacksonville Port Authority board, so he'll be switching over to JEA, have confirmed. It's not really a conflict of interest. I mean, in the sense that these appointees almost always are people who support a mayor. And it's interesting, like I said, that Curry has appointed somebody like, say, Bobby Stein, who certainly has not been on the same page of him as JEA and was not shy about pushing questions through the Civic Council about him.
And we're talking about two big stories right now with David Bauerlein of the Times Union, new board members proposed for JEA, and also federal funding coming into Jacksport to deepen the river. 549-2937. You know, I've touched on this when you've been on the show before, David. President Trump ran for president and won on the whole issue of trade, saying over and over again that China is killing us. We're getting killed by China. They're eating our lunch. We've got to start a trade war and slap tariffs on imported goods because China's just killing us. Well, okay, so that message resonated. At the same time now, the president is proposing millions of dollars so that Jacksport can deepen itself, so that we can allow China to send cheap goods flowing into this country a little more easily.
It's very contradictory.
It's very contradictory, to say the least, isn't it?
It is. And so there is some people have made that criticism as well, which is why should you make it more economical for China goods to come into the country?
I mean, because that's essentially what this is all about.
Right. The argument would be that this benefits American consumers. But you're right. I mean, that means that, you know, jobs are not going to come back home. These manufacturing jobs in China are going to stay in China and keep growing there because you're just feeding that particular global dynamic that makes it cheaper to import goods from Asia than it would be to make the manufacturing here in the U.S.
And to be clear, the port is saying if the ships coming in are bigger, that creates more jobs both at the port and around the port. Can you explain that dynamic a little bit?
Right. I mean, most of the jobs that are connected to the port are not right there on the docks because those are becoming more and more automated as well. I mean, there will be some additional longshoremen jobs, for instance, and related jobs like that. The real idea is that if you can have more of this cargo coming to Jacksonville, then after it comes off the ship, it goes to the distribution centers. Those distribution centers are got additional jobs, and you're really making this a global hub. The way, say, Savannah's been able to take its huge port traffic and really generate a lot of jobs that are not on the docks, but they're dependent on the port. If there's no port, those jobs go away.
Charles is in Jacksonville. Hi, Charles. Good morning. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. I was just wondering why the city council might look into the idea of having a floodgate at the mouth of the St. Johns River. in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Those people are certainly experts on flooding. They have a floodgate there that when a storm comes up, it closes and keeps out the high tide that would damage the city.
Sure. Yeah, thank you for that idea. And you're absolutely right. Down in South Florida, city leaders down there have been talking with the Dutch for years about how to take some of their ideas and import them over here to Florida. We haven't seen that in Jacksonville yet, but we might at some point.
First concept, I've never heard of that concept before, and I guess I would wonder if like the law of unintended consequences might be there too. I mean, we've obviously, you know, over the years, part of what's happened with this river is they put in the jetties to prevent sand from blocking the river all the time. So that's why we have Huguenot Park. And that's why we have all this sand buildup in Fort George Inlet. So no good deed goes unpunished in terms of how these things start messing with Mother Nature. Things happen that you don't anticipate. Right. I've never heard of that. That's kind of wild, like kind of a wall.
I think they've experimented with it in Venice, Italy, too, because Venice is slowly sinking into the water. Scott at the beaches. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hey, Melissa. Thanks. Great topic. Hey, I remember a couple of years ago, I think there was a local professor that did a study and said that the Panamax ships might not even come to Jacksonville. They might just bypass us. Has there been any updates to that? Do we know if this, if there's a return on this investment?
Right. That's Professor Jaffe at UNF, Scott, and he did a study that, as I said, it had far less rosy projections for what the port could accomplish economically with this deepening project. There is no guarantee we can attract all of the biggest ships. I mean, they're essentially taking a bit of a gamble with this, aren't they?
They are. Anna and David's done a lot of great research on this. So, I mean, my understanding, the big ships are coming here. They're not heavily loaded, and so that's a constraint on them. It's my thought has always been that there will be ships that have come from the Asian trade when you go to 47 feet. Is that really going to be enough to justify what's a huge amount of spending? You're, you know, almost $500 million of spending, incredible amount of money that's going into this project. Is there enough of a return on investment to justify that kind of expenditure? Jacksonville's got a fierce competitor to the north in Savannah. Mm-hmm. And everybody thinks, well, Savannah's going to run out of room. They're going to run out of room. And then these cargo companies are going to go to Jacksonville. And Savannah's not running out of room. They keep building their port bigger. They're going to build their bridges taller, and they're going to keep building more and more of these distribution centers. They say, show no sign of letting up. And right now they're the big dog in the southeast.
Hmm. Peggy in Arlington. Go ahead, Peggy.
Well, good morning. I want to thank this gentleman and the rest of the Times Union staff for keeping us up to date and involved in this JEA fiasco.
Thank you.
My question is, and the mayor appointed the board that is resigning in February. How can we trust him to appoint people that are not going to be doing his agenda?
Okay, thank you for that.
Well, that's a good question. We don't know what he said to the people he's appointing in terms of what he asked them to do or what he asked them to carry out their duties in what way. I mean, obviously, anytime a mayor appoints, there's an expectation that the people who are appointed are, you know, not going to do things completely opposite of what he wants to do. So I do go back to the point that, you know, there's some people there have been on JEA before. It doesn't strike me as a group that is just a bunch of rubber stampers for the mayor. I could be wrong about that, but it doesn't strike me that way.
Kay, Miss Kay in Jacksonville. Hi, Kay. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I just want to know, why did all of these people resign? I mean, sometimes that could be very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. They all stepped down as one.
So
it was shocking.
I think there were some conversations with the mayor prior to that. I mean, this was an effort, I think, by City Hall, the mayor's office, to get a clean slate, to start anew, start fresh. So it was not like they all independently decided on the same day, we're going to resign. It was an effort worked in tandem with the mayor's office to create this fresh board opportunity for a reset for JEA.
We are getting lots of calls and emails and tweets for David Bauerlein about two big stories, proposed new leadership for the JEA board, and news that the port is getting millions in federal funding to do its dredging project. Here's another tweet from Jim. I predict that when it's all said and done, the St. John's River will see more LNG export ships in the channel than Panamax ships. We'll have to see. And he's talking about liquid natural gas.
Right.
Okay. Let's go to Sarah in Atlantic Beach. Sarah, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. Hi, Melissa. It's Sarah Boren with USGBC Florida. And my question about the JEA
U.S. Green Building Council. I just want to get that. That's what you said? Yes.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Good morning. So my question is about the JEA board. What about dedicated seats? So it creates a lot of energy and pumps a lot of water, you know, having a dedicated engineer seat. And since it's a municipal utility, what about a dedicated citizen seat? Having the expertise we need to take JEA forward and be the utility we need it to be, both going into the future, but also to, correct its course action right now.
Thank you, Sarah.
That's an interesting concept. I don't think it's really been put forward in legislation, but that would be one approach to take, which would be you want to make sure that you have different perspectives that are represented on the board, whatever the policy might be. I've not seen that proposed. It's not something I really see very often in city boards, but certainly that would be an interesting concept. So you make sure you have every viewpoint is there at the table every time these big discussions come up. I mean, you're talking about a $2 billion agency. There's a lot of decision-making, a lot of impact it has in a lot of different ways.
Here's an email from a listener. There's a binding international treaty called International Maritime Organization, IMO Annex 6. Why should American taxpayers subsidize our Asian competition? Use $500 million instead to create jobs for local workers to upgrade to zero net carbon buildings and vehicles. So getting lots and lots of input. Oh, we have a councilman on the line. It's City Councilman Ron Salem joining the show. Hi, Councilman. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning, David.
Morning.
I just wanted to make a couple. I'm driving to Orlando and just wanted to make a couple of points. I hope I'm coming across clearly. Two of the seven appointments were recommendations of other council members, and I'm not sure that you're aware of that.
Which two?
Pardon me?
Which two?
Dr. Faison from Edward Waters and Dr. Haley from UF Health.
Oh, okay.
Number two, I have been the liaison to the Port Authority since my election, and John Baker is one of the finest people I've watched in this city. And if anyone has any question of what he's contributed to Lenny Curry and his ability to have an independent voice, just watching, I hate to see him leave the port, but the JEA is gaining a great person.
Well, thanks for that. And what are your thoughts about the calls for you and your colleagues to appoint some of these board members outright in the future?
Well, that's going to take some time for that legislation to be proposed and be voted on. I'm very pleased with the overall quality of these seven people. Bobby Stein, if anyone knows Bobby, has been as critical of the mayor in this process of JEA privatization as anybody in this city. And I'm so pleased that he's accepted an appointment because he'll be a very independent voice. I think it's critical that we get seven people on this board, and hopefully we can get these people on by the end of February, 1st of March. And then I'm hopeful that in the future we can have a role in making appointments. But as I said, two of these seven were recommendations of council members. So it's not like the mayor is ignoring recommendations of the council.
Well, I so appreciate you calling, and thank you for your insights there. That's City Councilman Ron Salem calling in as he heads to Point South. So thanks for that. And thank you, David Bauerlein, as always. Great to get your insights. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And much more ahead. We'll be right back.
Like many historic parts of Jacksonville, Springfield is changing fast. Join WJCT and the Jackson for a neighborhood walking tour on Saturday, February 29th. Exploring Springfield's past, imagining its future, is led by the Jackson's Ennis Davis. Tickets are limited for this guided tour. Get yours now at wjct.org/events and see you on Main Street.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. High school students and young adults are often more motivated than older generations when it comes to the issue of climate change. That's happening here in this area as well. We're going to learn more from David Weindorf, PhD. He's professor and B.L. Allen Endowed Chair of Pedology at the Department of Plant and Soil Science at Texas Tech University. But Weindorf is spending time here in Florida at Jacksonville's Episcopal School to give them guidance on their climate change program. He joins us now in today's Going Green. Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So students at Episcopal reached out to us and said we needed to talk to you, which is exciting to have you on the show. Tell us about your research and what brought you to town.
So I'm a classically trained soil scientist, and I've worked over the last year and a half with a junior at Episcopal here in Jacksonville named Julia Cagulari. She reached out to me by email and said, hey, I have this science fair project I'm working on. Could you potentially help me out with this? And I said, yeah, that sounds great. Brought her out to Texas Tech in West Texas. Gave her some help in terms of statistical analysis, experimental design, those kinds of things. And one thing led to another. And this last year, we actually found ourselves in North Dakota, actively sampling in four different lignite coal mines.
Oh, wow.
What we did was use some portable sensor technologies to determine the sulfur content of that lignite coal right there on site. And this research was so novel that she and I worked together to publish a peer-reviewed paper in the International Journal of Coal Geology. So she's a published author at 17.
That's not your run-of-the-mill science fair project.
That is not your run-of-the-mill science project. And indeed, we have even a patent pending on this technology.
Wow, that's amazing. And what are the implications of this research? And how does it coordinate with Episcopal's climate change curriculum they're teaching the kids?
Yeah, so the idea is, you know, when you burn lignite coal that has sulfur in it, the higher sulfur content basically goes up into the atmosphere, forms sulfuric acid, which is acid rain. And so the idea is if you're going to burn coal, you want to try to burn the cleanest coal possible. Currently, the only way they can determine the sulfur content of this coal is to send samples back to the lab and wait for the analysis. The technology that we're bringing to the table puts in the hands of these coal miners this actual technology that allows them to make determinations of the sulfur content right there on site in 1 minute.
Interesting. And what's the reaction been so far?
Oh, it's been incredible. I mean, in talking to these miners up in North Dakota, nobody had ever seen any kind of technology like this, which is really amazing. I mean, these are big coal companies, and they just were totally unfamiliar with these types of approaches. So here in Jacksonville, you know, Julia took this project and used this for her science fair project, and she qualified for the International Science Fair competition last night, which we're really excited about. But beyond that, yesterday was Global Community Day at Episcopal, and I spoke with the kids about some of the 32 different countries that I've worked in around the world, and some of the, you know, the climate change implications that I've seen, whether it's in northern Alaska, in West Africa, different parts of the world.
What's the most dramatic climate change that you've seen in coastal your
erosion.
Travels?
I would say coastal erosion in northern Alaska. I've completed a documentary film on that subject, and we've actually documented erosion rates along the Beaufort Sea of it cutting back into the tundra at a rate of 15 feet per year for hundreds of miles. And that was research supported by the National Science Foundation.
When you work with young people like Julia and her students, her fellow students at Episcopal, what do they say to you when they talk about climate change? What's at the top of their mind?
It's just so motivating to work with them because they want to make a difference. You talk to older people and they already have their minds made up. They're like, don't believe this. Or, you know, they kind of already ingrained in their thought process. But these young kids, they want to get good information. They want to learn more and they want to make a difference. They realize that there's a lot riding on the choices that they make, and we're really excited to help them.
Sure. It's going to affect them far more than it will affect older adults.
It is. Yeah. And it's just going to become more important with time.
Well, I hope you enjoyed your time in Jacksonville.
It's been fantastic.
It's really cool to learn about this. And the kids are all right, aren't they?
They really are. Excellent, excellent.
They really are. He's David Weindorf, PhD, professor at Texas Tech. He was part of Episcopal's Global Community Day and some groundbreaking research coming out of that high school. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Back in a moment. Well, speaking of the next generation of leaders, Leadership Jacksonville is seeking some bright young people right now for its next generation program. That's right. Not only do adults go through Leadership Jacksonville, so do young people, students and young adults. Meg Folds is Leadership Jacksonville's youth programs director, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks so much for having us here.
Thank you for being here. I'm a proud alum of LJ, class of 2013. Shout out to all of my fellow classmates out there that might be listening. And so people tend to think of Leadership Jacksonville as a program for adults, but the Next Generation program is so dynamic. Can you tell us more about it?
Absolutely. This is our program for 18 to 30-year-olds that are here in our community going to college or interning or working in our community. And we're anxious to have them apply for our program and come and be a part of it this summer.
It's coming up this summer. And what will they do? How is it similar or different to the adult program?
We have less time to squeeze in the experiences, but we start with an opening retreat. It's a two-day retreat, and then we have four program days spread over weekdays during the summer, and we end with a closing retreat on a Saturday. And in that time, we try to explore all sorts of aspects of our community and really have the participants talk with the leaders and in many different segments of our community and really go behind the scenes and see what is happening in our community and how they can make an impact on it.
And so people are clear, this next generation is for undergraduate and graduate students, interns and young professionals aged 18 to 30. And what I love reading about this, Meg, is since you began this program, graduates of Next Generation Leadership Jacks are 90% more likely to stay in the community than move away.
We're so proud of that. We really are. It's an anonymous evaluation. So there's no prompting, but that's what they say. We find that the young people are so much prouder of their community and also now know how to get involved. And they also make lifelong friendships with this very diverse group of young people that we bring together.
What if you are a young person who wants to apply, but you can't necessarily afford to go through it? Can you talk a little bit about the scholarship opportunities for this?
Sure. We do have limited scholarships. Also, what we find is so many employers are willing to sponsor their own employees. This is an amazing opportunity also for companies, for their young people working in their organization, and interns that they bring in. Because we have that great percentage rate of those wanting to live and work in our community after completing the program, it really enhances their investment in an intern, especially if they want to have them come and work for them later on as a full-time employee. So yes, we have scholarships, but we also are very proud of how many people are willing to sponsor candidates.
Sponsor someone to apply. So really, you're here today to really get the word out that now is the time to apply, and there's a deadline coming up, right?
There sure is. The application is on our website. Just go to leadershipjax.org. You'll see it right on the homepage. You can click on that. The deadline is April 6th. We do telephone interviews with all of the applicants, and then we make our decision on who will be on the, in the class in May. And then we get started at the end of the May, end of May.
Okay, so if you or a young person you know might be interested in Next Generation, apply now at Leadership Jacksonville. They are accepting applications for students, interns, and young professionals. LeadershipJax.org to apply. And I can personally attest it's worth it. So Meg Folds, it's always good to see you. Thank you for spreading the word here with us.
Thank you, Melissa, and thanks for all your help.
Thank you so much.
With our programs.
A quick break, and you know what's coming up Friday, Valentine's Day. In a moment, don't miss some live singing in studio. We had Singing Valentines on the show yesterday from the guys. Today, it's Singing Valentines from the ladies. That's right. The Jacksonville Harmony Chorus will perform right after this, and you can send your sweetie one of their Valentines. Don't go away.
WJCT invites you to join us for an evening with Ari Shapiro on Thursday, April 2nd, award-winning journalist and weekday co-host of All Things Considered, NPR's award-winning afternoon news program, will join WJCT's president and CEO, David McGowan, for an engaging conversation. Visit wjct.org/events for ticket information.
The Players Championship returns to TPC Sawgrass March 10th through 15th. Admission for kids 15 and under is complimentary with a ticketed adult. Tickets and parking information available at theplayers.com.
Congaree and Penn offers an elevated farm setting for private events. With all-encompassing farm-to-table culinary service, the farm's acres are a unique backdrop for special occasions. More at congareeandpenn.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Jill Winebanks, who was a young lawyer in the special prosecutor's office during the Watergate investigation and is now an MSNBC legal analyst. She'll talk about confronting Nixon administration insiders on the witness stand, enduring sexism in the courtroom, and how the Watergate probe differs from investigations into President Trump. Join us. Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
More than a million Americans have type 1 diabetes.
It became harder to recognize whether my blood sugar was going too high or whether it was going too low.
Some have turned to service dogs to help manage the disease.
But in fact, maybe the dog's right half the time.
The hope and the hype of diabetic alert dogs, plus New Hampshire primary analysis this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT.
New Hampshire has always been a crucial early decider in the race for the presidency. And after Iowa, the stakes for the candidates in this primary are higher than ever. I'm Todd Zwillick. Is the path ahead for Democrats any clearer? Or should the party prepare for a contested convention? That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it is your opportunity to show your sweetheart how you really feel. You can book a singing Valentine with the Jacksonville Harmony Chorus. They are in studio right now, Susan Brooks and company. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. It's so good to have you back on the show. You know, yesterday we had the gentleman singing the Big Orange Chorus. You are the Jack's Harmony Chorus. Tell us all about your group.
I will. We are Sapphire Quartet, and we absolutely do represent Jacksonville Harmony Chorus. We have a great time with our group of ladies. And yes, we are doing Singing Valentines on Friday with a variety of options to choose from. And you know, we're a nonprofit organization. This is our large fundraiser of the year to help us defray costs of this group of ladies. So we have a great time.
So what's the craziest reaction you've ever gotten when you went out to deliver a singing Valentine?
Well, you know, there have been tears.
Tears. Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, there has been amazement. We'd even had people kind of almost try to run away because they're embarrassed.
Did you just keep singing?
Absolutely.
You just keep going. The show must go on, right? So who is most likely to call you at this time? And is it husbands sending to wives? Is that the most common?
That probably is the most common, but it's also wives sending to husbands. And then we have a fair share of children wanting to send to their moms or dads or both. It's all over the map, really.
Okay. And what do you ladies love about singing the four-part harmony? And you perform not just at Valentine's Day too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We perform all over the city. We have shows periodically, Christmas performances throughout for community events, private events, anything. We're very open. But, you know, the joy of singing a cappella music and just the joy of singing with a group is just amazing. And it's very healthy for you to do so. The endorphins start kicking in. It's just, you just can't really describe it. It's awesome.
That's right. You are the real life version of Pitch Perfect right here in Jacksonville.
Well, that's a compliment.
It's so exciting. And so, by the way, the Jack's Harmony Chorus has been sharing the a cappella magic in Jacksonville for more than 55 years. They are part of Sweet Adeline's International. So you're going to sing for us now. What are we going to be treated to?
Well, we're going to sing a song called I Don't Know Why.
I don't know why I love you like I do. I don't know why I just do. I don't know why I love you like I do. I don't know why I just do. I don't know why you thrill me like you do. I don't know why you just do. Yes, you do. You always seem to want my romancing. I love the way you hold me when we are dancing. I don't know why I love you like I do. I don't know why, I just do. I just do.
All right. That made the hair on my wrist rise a little bit. That's how good that was. Oh my goodness.
You enjoyed it. We have a lot of fun.
It's so great. Book your singing Valentine today because Friday is 2 days away. Go to jacksharmony.org and send your sweetie a singing Valentine. Can you guys do one more for us?
Sure.
Okay, as we close out the show, let's listen again to the Sapphire Quartet from the Jacksonville Harmony Chorus. I'm Melissa Ross. Let's have a very romantic end of the show. What are you going to sing?
What are you going to sing?
Orange Color.
Oh.
I'm so sorry.
Sorry, I put you on the spot.
Okay, we're going to sing a song called Orange Colored Sky.
Orange Colored Sky. Okay. Here they are one more time.
Okay.
Walking along, singing a song, when I saw you walk by. I was walking along, minding my business, when out of an orange-colored sky, flash, bam, bam, alakazam, wonderful you came by. I was humming a tune, drinking in sunshine, when out of an orange-colored view.
Wham,
wham, bam,
bam,
alakazam, I gotta look at you. One look and I yell, timber, watch out for flying glass. The ceiling fell in and the bottom fell out. I went into a spin and I started to shout, I've been hit. This is it. This is it. Walking along, minding my business, when love came and hit me in the eye.
Flash,
bam,
bam,
alakazam,
out of an orange-colored sky.
One look and I yell,
timber,
watch out for flying glass.
The ceiling fell in and the bottom fell out. I went into a spin and I started to shout, I've been hit.
This is it. This is it. Walking along, minding my business, when love came and hit me in the eye.
Flash,
bam,
bam,
alakazam,
out of an
orange-colored, purple-striped, pretty green polka-dotted sky.
Flash,
bam,
bam,
alakazam, alakazam.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.